Howard versus AmeriCredit Financial. Mr. Zepp.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brian Zepp on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Aubrey Howard. Your Honors, the hanging paragraph found in Section 1325 of the Bankruptcy Code is a narrow exception to the creditors, or to the bifurcation of a creditor secured claim.
Well, but the problem is, so it does say shall not apply to, you know, a certain purchase money security interest. So aren't the cases right when they say we have to go to state law to figure out what a purchase money security interest is, what it covers?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Well, when we do that, don't we find that a purchase money security interest secures a lot more than just the, you know, principal of the of the loan?
No, Your Honor.
Finance charges, interest, this and that. Yeah, all right.
Those are rooted. They're transaction costs. They're rooted in the purchase of any vehicle, and they'll be the same identical. They'll be identical to any purchaser trying to purchase that vehicle. Negative equity varies from purchaser to purchaser, and is completely dependent.
Interest charges, finance charges, all that varies from purchaser to purchaser.
Correct, Your Honor, but you do not need to finance negative equity to purchase a vehicle. To acquire rights in that vehicle, you do not need to purchase, or you do not need to finance negative equity. The problem here is I think the circuits, they have created a new test to shoehorn negative equity into being part of a purchase money secured interest. They call it the package deal approach, and they believe that the financing of negative equity enabled the purchaser to acquire rights in that vehicle, and without the financing of negative equity, they would not have been able to purchase that vehicle. The problem with that is, Your Honor, there's nowhere in the UCC text or the comments stating anything about a package deal. The text of the UCC discusses value given to enable to acquire rights in the collateral, not value given to enable the transaction to acquire rights in the vehicle.
In the Second Circuit case, when they certified the issue to the New York Court of Appeals, the New York Court said, yeah, this was part of the purchase money security interest. And why? That seems to be the only case. Is that the only state case?
That is the only state case.
Why shouldn't, you know, New York Court of Appeals is a respected court. Is there anything special about New York law that would differentiate that case from our situation?
Absolutely. They looked at negative equity. They looked at the purchase, the price of a collateral, and they looked to their motor vehicle statute.
Well, they mentioned that, but that was the secondary point they make. They start off with just, isn't it their interpretation of the UCC? Even if they go on and say, you know, its conclusion is bolstered by this New York statute.
Correct. They do, but they rely that the legislative intent in New York, because they used cash sale price, and their cash sale price included negative equity, that the legislators intended price to be negative equity be included in price under the UCC. The other problem I think that the circuits created here is when they're looking at this package deal approach, they're only looking at this in the context of a bankruptcy. Chapter 13 debtors are not the only people who utilize financing negative equity. If we look at...
But apparently this is a routine thing. They do it all the time. And
correct, Your Honor, but if you look...
First, well, there have been these cases that challenge it in bankruptcy, but apparently in the ordinary course in state law... Well, of course, it's the cram-down issue. That only arises in bankruptcy.
The problem here is, Your Honor, they're looking at it in the context of a bankruptcy, and they're saying that the debtor would have never been able to acquire rights in that vehicle if there wasn't financing of negative equity. If we look at this outside of the bankruptcy context and look at Harry the hedge fund manager, and he rolls into a BMW dealership. He wants to turn in his vehicle. He's being offered 2% financing. He has $8,000 of negative equity in the car he's turning in. At the same time, he has an account at Goldman Sachs with money earning 10%. Why would he ever pull out $8,000 where it's earning 10% when he can finance the negative equity at 2%?
How representative is that of the average person that walks into a dealership with negative equity. I mean, I appreciate the purity of your hypothetical, but is it very representative?
But the problem here is, Your Honor, I believe that the UCC is for uniformity, and it shouldn't, and it's blind to wealth, and it shouldn't matter that a hedge fund manager who decides he wants to utilize the 2% financing because his net return is 8% on that $8,000. How can we then say that negative equity enabled him to do that purchase? He could have easily paid off the entire negative equity amount, but he utilized the purchase. He utilized the 2% financing. Your Honor.
Let me ask you, do you think Congress really meant to exclude an entire class of claims from the hanging paragraph solely on the basis that they happen to contain negative equity?
I think the intent behind Congress was to protect the normal transaction where someone goes in and finances a car, and then immediately it goes driven off the lot and it depreciates. And then they come in and file a bankruptcy and bifurcate the claim pursuant to 506. The problem here with negative equity is the moment they do the financing, they're already upside down on the vehicle. I can't imagine that Congress intended to protect a high-risk loan by a subprime lender from bifurcation under 506. This vehicle here, I believe, they financed 120% of the actual value of the vehicle. The vehicle comes off the lot. It probably depreciates another 10% by the time its tires hit the street. At this point, they have financed 130% the value of the vehicle. I just don't believe that Congress intended to protect a high-risk lending practices.
But if we rule that the negative equity portion of the claim is not entitled to the hanging paragraph protection, what happens to the rest of the claim?
The rest of the claim falls outside of the hanging paragraph.
So under your reading, why would a creditor ever take on a negative equity charge if it could jeopardize the priority of the entire claim in a bankruptcy?
Your Honor, if you read the amicus brief, they cite that 28 to 38% of car loans prior to 2005 were doing negative equity. These lenders are in the business of lending money. That's why they're trying to overload the PMSI with as much negative equity as possible. I don't believe by finding that the negative equity part of a claim falls outside of the hanging paragraph, they'll stop doing negative equity loans. They were.
What do we know about the previous purchase, the purchase of the car that he turned in?
It's not part of
the payment.
It's not part of the record, Your Honor. I believe the previous car loan was with Ironworks. It's on the contract. That is part of the record. I'm not sure that anything about it. I don't know the percentage. But here, he could have financed the negative equity. He could have taken out a payday loan with some ridiculous interest rate or an unsecured loan from one of the big banks like HSBC, Beneficial, at 20%, 26% interest on an unsecured loan. He decided to utilize the negative, the 12.9.
Of course, because if he can give the car dealer an interest which is protected against cram down, he'll get a better deal from the dealer. They're both better off, right?
Well,
the more security you can give for a loan, the lower the interest rate. And the problem with the automobiles, of course, is because of their rapid depreciation, it's very hard for the seller to obtain adequate security if he faces cram down.
Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. I believe that they give out, determine the interest rate based on probably credit scores. So if why would they not lend negative equity financing to Harry the hedge fund guy who has a Goldman Sachs account?
The more security a lender has, the lower the interest rate, because the less costly a default is to him, right?
Theoretically, Your Honor, but I don't believe.
Theoretically.
I don't believe that the auto loans are made that way.
What's that about? I don't understand.
Your Honor, if somebody could
say that all this lending business is irrational, fine. But that won't really help your argument. I mean, if you have a rational lender, the more secure, the better security is, the less he's going to lose in a default. So he'll offer better deals to these people. It's implicit in what you said about this guy can go and get a payday loan at 300%, right? Because a payday lender wouldn't have any confidence in his ability to repay.
But the thing here is, Your Honor, under the UCC, the test is there's a close nexus between value given to enable to acquire rights in the collateral. There's no value given to enable him to acquire rights in the collateral if he's just utilizing a better interest rate. He could pull money out of an account that's earning him a better return, but why would he do that? Why would he pull money out earning 10% when he can borrow at 2%?
Well, he can borrow cheaply. He can. You mean from the dealer?
From the dealer. He's
Okay, the more secure security you give to the dealer, as you say, the lower the interest rate. Right? So if there's no cram down, dealer feels better, and he's got an extra 6,000 or whatever it is of security that's immune from cram down, and so he'll give the buyer a better deal.
Your Honor,
people who are hurt by this are other creditors, right? He's not hurt. The dealer isn't. It's other creditors.
Well, the unsecured
credit. There isn't anything about the impact on other creditors of this person.
Your Honors,
are they the victims of this kind of avoidance of cram down?
The other purchasers,
the
unsecured creditors. In this case, yeah, they would be. They would be because they're getting a higher secured amount. So it would take longer for them to get their unsecured dividend of 10%.
Right.
We're trying to cram down, I believe, $21,000. Instead, he's going to have to pay $21,000 before the unsecured creditors will get their dividend. His case will last a lot longer.
Well, why do you think there's such a lineup of cases against your position?
Again, Your Honor, I believe that they're reading a new test. This package deal approach, it doesn't exist in the UCC or the comments. We're not arguing that there isn't a package deal here.
Why are there courts that say that?
Your Honor, we're not arguing that there's a package deal here. But part of the package deal is purchase money secured interest. The money advanced to pay for the actual price of the vehicle plus the expenses that are listed in comment 3, that portion of the loan, that is purchase money secured interest. The amount of money that paid Ironworks, the previous creditor, who has an antecedent debt, it's a pre-existing claim, that portion of the money is not purchased money secured interest. And what the courts are looking at is, I believe they're looking at this from the context of a Chapter 13 debtor. They need to look at this in an everyday transaction. How can we say that that money enabled him to purchase the vehicle? He could have borrowed from someone else. He utilized 12.95% interest. Your Honors, I see that I'm running into my rebuttal time. I'd like to...
That's fine. Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Zeff. Mr. Berg?
Good morning. May it please the Court, my name is William Burke, and I represent the Appellee AmeriCredit Financial Services in this appeal. And I'm privileged to be here arguing this case for AmeriCredit because this case is of enormous importance to the automobile sales and financing industries and to the public which they support. The precise issue presented to this honorable court has been the subject of 7 opinions from 6 different federal circuit courts and 1 opinion from New York's highest court. And every one of those opinions supports the position taken by AmeriCredit in this appeal. Indeed, the overwhelming majority of opinions at every level of review throughout the country now support AmeriCredit. The seminal and leading authority dealing with the hanging paragraph is this Court's opinion in the In re Wright case. And although the Wright case did not involve the same precise issue presented here, negative equity, we believe that the opinion is instructive and helpful because of the Court's emphasis upon the purposes of the hanging paragraph and its preambles, and the Court's focus upon state law and the need to enforce the contract of the parties as written. Indeed, it's important to note that a great many of the negative equity cases that have been decided in our favor cite and rely on the Wright case. Now, most of the cases, as Your Honor pointed out, and all of the circuit cases rely upon state law, and that state law is Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code and state retail installment sales acts.
But there doesn't actually seem to be anything in the UCC that bears on the issue, is there? It doesn't say anything.
Bears on which issue, Your Honor?
Of negative equity.
There's a good reason for that, and I'm glad you asked that question. There's nothing in Comment 3 that lists negative equity, and that's been brought up repeatedly in the briefs in these cases. But there's a good reason for that. In 1995, the co-sponsors of the Uniform Commercial Code, the American Law Institute and the National Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, appointed a drafting committee to rewrite Article 9. I was privileged to serve as the chair of that drafting committee. And we were instructed, as a drafting committee, to address issues that had come up in the cases and resulted in divided opinions or controversy or uncertainty. And so we did that. We completed our work in 1998, and the act was, revised Article 9 was adopted in every state effective 2001. Now, the point I want to make here is that as of 1998, when we completed our work on Article 9, there was not a single case involving negative equity under Comment 2 or Section 9107, old Section 9107, which was replaced by current Section 9103. And the reason we didn't see cases involving negative equity and therefore didn't address the issue is because vehicle liens and consumer transactions are perfected under certificate of title statutes. And that's where negative equity is presented, is in vehicle liens. So as of 1998, there wasn't a single case involving negative equity in any of the reported decisions under Article 9. That's why it wasn't addressed. It wasn't until BAPSIPA was adopted in 2005 that we began to see these negative equity cases cropping up under Article 9, and that was 7 years after
work was completed on Article 9. We should be looking at.
Okay. Well, first of all, Section 9103, which replaced 9107, defines the term that is at the crux of this appeal, and that term is purchase money security interest. And it states that a security interest is purchase money if it secures an obligation for all or part of the price of the collateral or for value given to enable the debtor to acquire rights in or use of the collateral. Comment 3, which is critical here and which Your Honor quoted earlier when my opposing counsel was arguing, sets forth a very broad and generous test for purchase money security interest and qualifies a whole assortment of expenses and charges as purchase money obligations, including obligations for expenses incurred in connection with acquiring the rights
and
the property.
What about the taxi you took to go to the dealer, you know, something like that?
Huh? No, it wouldn't include those, Your Honor, for a variety of reasons. Again, opposing counsel and in these other cases have brought up a whole assortment of potential abuses they claim will result if this court affirms the decision of the bankruptcy court and rules like the other courts in favor of AmeriCredit. They point out emergency appendectomies and purchase of lollipops and taxi charges and all sorts of credit card fees. The fact of the matter is, in the over 70 of the negative equity cases that have been decided, not one case involved a fact pattern even remotely similar to those posed by opposing counsel.
If such a case arose, how would we distinguish it from this case?
Because in this case, we have the charge for negative equity was specifically negotiated by the parties as part of a package transaction. The charge for negative equity was inextricably related to the purchase transaction. The charge for negative equity was absolutely required to be incurred by the debtor in order to complete the purchase of the vehicle. That's not true in these other examples. And by the way, just to point out, a number of the other federal circuit courts in considering these potential.
What if he said to the dealer, "Well, or the dealer said, "You don't have very good credit and so on. I'd really like to add your emergency appendectomy to the contract, and that way, you know, if you default, I won't have to worry about cram down. I'll have this additional payment that's immune from cram down." In fact, it's written in the contract doesn't do the trick for you.
No, but in that circumstance, Your Honor, I don't believe there's a couple of answers to that. First of all, that particular type of charge and expense would not be permitted by the Illinois Motor Vehicle Retail Installment Sales Act as a permitted charge. Negative equity is specifically listed in the Illinois Act as a permitted authorized charge. So that's one answer. But the second answer is I don't believe that a charge like that for an emergency appendectomy, as an example, or payment of credit card fees would meet the close nexus test of Comment 3 like charges for negative equity do. It just wouldn't meet that test. And I'd like to point out that this same question has been considered by the other federal circuit courts, and they've all described it as hyperbolic, unrealistic, and not presenting a question that's before the court today. Counsel has not given one reason why.
Mr. Zeff's point. So he says, well, you know, the finance charge and so on, you have to do that to buy the car. But you don't need negative equity to buy a car. You could, as you said, you could borrow the money. And so how do you respond to that?
The fact of the matter is, Your Honor, when Mr. Howard came into the dealership and he talked about the low interest rate, in a lot of these cases the interest rate is zero. So it makes every bit of sense for them to want to finance the negative equity through the dealership. When Mr. Howard came into the dealership with his used car and offered it as a trade-in, that was his choice. He decided he wanted to trade it in. And when he made that choice, since that car was worth less than the amount of the debt on it, he was absolutely required to discharge that negative equity. That was an absolutely mandatory requirement for the transaction to be completed. That was his choice. And so I think that if you put up a test that says that it has to be something that occurs in every single transaction, which, by the way, is not the test in comment 3, we submit. But if you assume that it was, we meet that test. Because every single purchaser of a motor vehicle from a dealership that trades in his used vehicle that's underwater absolutely must discharge the debt on that vehicle and incur the charge for negative equity. So we meet that false test.
So what happens exactly? He turns in the trade-in. Does that mean that the dealer who's selling him the new car has to pay the old?
Oh, absolutely.
So that happens right away? Or?
Yes, because if the trade-in comes into the dealership and the dealer accepts it, and it's got debt on it owed to another finance company secured by a lien, that dealer has to discharge that debt.
That triggers the obligation to repay
right.
the
Because
lien.
Otherwise, the dealer's not going to be able to sell a used car, no way he can sell it, and the owner of the lien on the used car, the previous lien holder, is going to repossess it or sue either the dealership or the new purchaser. So that's why it's a mandatory component of the transaction to discharge that negative equity. And the courts have relied heavily upon that in these decisions. It's inextricably related. We submit, Your Honor, that we submit that Howard's purchase of the new car and his trade-in of his used car was a single, integrated, reciprocal, mutually dependent transaction. And that's why it meets the close nexus test. And we submit that because Howard would not have bought the new car unless the dealer accepted his used car as a trade-in and paid off the debt on it. In turn, the dealer would not have accepted Howard's used car unless he purchased the new car. Mm-hmm. One transaction could not and would not have happened without the other. That's why we submit that it's a single integrated transaction and not two separate transactions as opposing counsel has claimed. If you posit, for example, a transaction in which Mr. Howard came into the dealership with positive equity in his used car and traded it in and got a credit against the purchase price for that positive equity, no one would seriously claim that that's not a single integrated transaction and not two separate unrelated transactions. And in fact, Howard would not be making that claim here because that separating the transactions in that way in a positive equity circumstance would increase the secured debt not subject to cram down.
It shouldn't
make a difference whether it's positive or negative equity is our point.
You didn't really address this whole question of certification to the Illinois Supreme Court. Do you think that's necessary?
No, I don't believe it's necessary. The Second Circuit certified the question in the Peasley case, and of course the New York Court of Appeals ruled that negative equity is a purchase money obligation, but it seems to me it's not necessary to do that here. We're dealing with the Uniform Commercial Code, Section 9103, is uniform in every state in the country. Now, some provisions of Article 9 differed from state to state, but 9103 is uniform throughout the country. Comment 3 is the same throughout the country. And we believe this honorable court, along with the 6 other federal circuit courts that have decided this issue, can rule on this issue, and there's no need to certify it.
The positive equity thing, I missed that. So he comes in, and his car is worth more than his debt. No. Okay.
Right.
Car is worth $10,000. He only owes $5,000. He has this $5,000 credit. So the dealer gives the new dealer gives him the credit.
Reduces the purchase price, right?
So reduce the purchase price by $5,000. Right. And
in that case, all I'm saying is that we would not see the debtors in these cases if there was positive equity coming in and saying, "Oh no, no, that's two separate transactions. You have the purchase of the new car, the trading of the used car. The trading of the used car is totally unrelated and independent and separate from the purchase of the new car." We wouldn't see them making those claims. They're only making it because it advantages them in terms of the charge for negative equity. The last point I want to make is a very important point, and it was brought up in the argument that preceded me here, and that is that the charge for negative equity is specifically authorized by the Illinois Motor Vehicle Retail Installment Sales Act as being a charge appropriate to a retail installment purchase transaction. And we think this is highly significant because the Illinois legislature, taking into account consumer preferences and long-standing industry practices, has determined that the charge for negative equity is closely related, closely connected, bears a close nexus to the purchase of new automobiles, and it should therefore be authorized by Illinois state law. And it's this close connection, close relationship, close nexus test that is set forth in comment 3. Now, just one last point. Counsel said, well, yes, but in the Reber case, as an example, the court was relying upon a New York Retail Installment Sales Act that includes negative equity as part of the cash price of the vehicle. And in his reply brief, he claimed we've taken inconsistent positions on this point. And that's just not true. I argued the Penrod case in the Ninth Circuit about a month ago. And we took the same position there that we took here. 36 states have authorized charges for negative equity, have authorized them as part of vehicle purchase transactions. Some of those states, like New York, California, and Georgia, include charges for negative equity as part of the cash price of the vehicle. Other states, like Illinois, include charges for negative equity as part of the amount financed or principal balance. Our position is it doesn't make any difference, because Article 9's reference to price, as is made clear by Comment 3, is the credit price, the time price, the deferred payment price, not the cash price. So it doesn't matter whether the state puts the charge for negative equity in as part of the cash price or the principal balance or the amount financed. It's all part of the credit price, time price, that is referred to in Article 9 and Comment 3. Even Mr. Zeff, counsel for Howard, has admitted this in his reply brief by saying that finance charges are part of the price of the vehicle under Article 9. And finance charges are not part of the cash price of the vehicle. So we've taken entirely consistent positions on this point. And I would simply point out that 16 of the negative equity decisions rely on state retail installment sales acts to conclude that the charge for negative equity is part of the price of the vehicle. 16, including two from the state of Illinois. And 9 of those 16 opinions rely on state retail installment sales acts that include charges for negative equity as part of the principal balance or amount financed and not the cash price. And that's why we think it's entirely irrelevant whether the state puts it in cash price or principal balance or amount financed. It's part of the credit price, and therefore it meets the Article 9 test.
Now, Mr. Burke, has Penrod, though it's relatively recent, had any impact on the industry in the Ninth Circuit?
Well, of course, and this goes to the point I think you raised in your question at the oral argument, or maybe it was Judge Williams, that the Penrod decision is going to have a totally negative effect on automobile financing. And charges for negative equity are frequently financed in automobile purchase transactions. They're very popular for the reasons that Mr. Zeft has pointed out. It's very low-rate financing. But if a dealer is going to face the prospect of having his entire claim disqualified from hanging paragraph protection because he makes an advance to pay the negative equity, an advance that the customer wants and is getting at a low rate of financing, if he's going to face the prospect of losing his entire claim because of a charge for negative equity being treated as non-purchase money, he's not going to finance that. And in that case, Mr. Zeff's client, Mr. Howard, is either not going to purchase the new car, or is going to have to borrow that money from somewhere else at a much higher interest rate. And that goes to the policy implications of this case and why it's so important to the automobile financing industry as well as to purchasers of motor vehicles.
I suspect if you are unsuccessful in your case, you'll be arguing it on the East Coast.
Arguing what?
You'll be arguing that case before the Supreme Court.
Well, we hope to be successful in this case. We would simply close by simply urge this court to issue a decision that affirms the decision of the lower court and is consistent with the six other federal circuit courts that have decided this issue and the opinion of this court in In Re Wright. That will facilitate uniformity among the circuits. It's the correct result. It will facilitate uniformity among the circuits. And it will also promote a uniform...
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Okay. Your time has expired. We'll hear from Mr. Zeft.
Sorry.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd first like to address this amount finance charge in the Motor Vehicle Retail Sales Act. The charges listed in there are cash sale price plus any itemized charge, excluding finance charges. The UCC Comment 3 lists finance charges as one of the expenses in price. The UCC has a close nexus test. Under an amount finance approach, it will lead to overloading purchase money secured interest because you can itemize any charge. Like the emergency surgery, you can itemize that on a contract, and under that theory,
Wait a second. So Mr. Burke said there's no difference between these state motor title statute there that talk about the cash that put negative equity that describe negative equity as part of the cash price, and other statutes describe it as part of the financed.
There's a huge difference between cash sale price.
What is the difference?
Cash sale price is the actual price of the vehicle, including expenses, mirroring those expenses listed in Comment 3 of the UCC. The only difference here between New York, California, and Georgia is in Illinois, cash sale price excludes negative equity. It does not include negative equity. In California, in front of the bankruptcy appellate...
What is the difference? I don't understand. What is the significance of that difference?
If you look at amount finance, you could include anything into purchase money secured interest because you can itemize it on a contract. Back to the emergency surgery. If the dealership wants to itemize that under the contract, you can finance that. The cap under amount financing. Amount financing is cash sale price plus any itemized charge. So you could put in that charge of the surgery as long as you can itemize it on a contract. There's a huge difference, Your Honor. Also, with the equity, a car you trade in with equity, you're trading a car in that has value. There is no value given to enable the transaction when it's an upside-down loan. When there's a equity in the car, you're actually giving value to the dealership. Also, Your Honor, there's...
Now, do you think that New York case was correctly decided?
Your Honor, I believe the way they define price, and by looking at their motor vehicle statute, there is an argument to say that the New York legislator intended to include negative equity in price because it's included in the cash price.
What about Mr. Burke's argument that 9103 is uniform in all the states? But when you tie it to the motor vehicle statutes, then you're going to, and your distinction between cash price and amount of finance, you're going to have different results in different states.
Correct. In Illinois, there will be a different result if they applied the cash sale price. That's why I believe certification would be appropriate here. There's no cases in the Illinois appellate court or Illinois Supreme Court that have decided on this exact issue. That's why I believe New York certified it to their highest court. This will have huge ramifications on the residents of Illinois if they're not allowed to cram down negative equity because this court believes that it's not.
But they haven't been cramming down. So
They were cramming it down, Your Honor. They were before the hanging paragraph. They were able to cram it down.
Yeah, but since then, when was that added to the?
That was added in 2005, and in the Central District, I believe the Hernandez case allows for them to cram it.
I just want to clear up one point. Did you say that when a consumer trades in a car with negative equity, he gives no value to the dealer?
There is no value.
Is that the industry's view of it? I mean,
well, no, you
pay off that negative equity, which the dealer must do to get title and possess the car. Is your presumption that what the dealer sells that property, the used auto, is he's going to lose money on what he...
No, what happens here is they trade in a car with negative equity. there's two transactions memorialized on one contract.
Right.
AmeriCredit finances advances funds to the dealership. That pays off the negative equity. I mean, that pays the actual vehicle. The other money AmeriCredit advances pays for nothing. It pays for an antecedent debt that goes to Ironworks.
Well, of course, so, Mr. Burke's point is that if your mode of payment for a new car is your old car traded in, and there's negative equity, then that negative equity has to be discharged. That has to be. Otherwise,
but the test,
you can't trade the car, right?
But no, you can't. You can trade the car, and if you find other financing.
Car in, when you sell a car to someone else, that triggers your obligation to the lender.
Right.
Someone has to pay off the lender.
Correct, and the way you choose financing, again, Mr. Howard could get financing from somewhere else. There's nothing in the record that states that he needed to.
No, I understand, but there has to be the elimination of the negative equity. That's part of the transaction.
Your Honor, but it's not value given to Enable. The car is upside down. The car has no value. It has absolutely no value. The difference is in a car that isn't upside down, there's equity. You can trade that in. You're offering value. There's no value. And again, the UCC.
Trade the car in. It does. The car has value. There's also a debt, right? You get rid of the debt, and then there's value.
But the test is a close nexus test. Value given to Enable.
Close. It's all part of the same transaction. That's
Your Honor, if that is the only test, you could overlook.
Powerful point. The way you do this, you don't go get a payday loan and what to pay off your $6,000 or whatever the negative equity is. It's all one deal. The new dealer pays off the negative equity.
Under that approach, Your Honor, it will lead to overloading purchase money secured interest because you could then you can as long as you're lending at the same time purchasing the vehicle and lending money at the same time to pay off credit card debt, you can roll in credit card debt into the car loan. And why not do that if you're paying 26% interest on your credit card?
Do we have any history of that?
Again, Your Honor.
Case. I understand you make a point. I think it's theoretically correct in some ways. But is that the course of the commerce of this industry?
Your Honor, we're looking at this, again, in the terms of bankruptcy, only bankruptcy cases. This is a tiny percentage of all negative equity type financing. And again, Your Honor, I believe that certification to this issue to the Illinois Supreme Court will be beneficial. They should have at least an opportunity to determine whether the legislators here believe that part of the price includes negative equity. If they looked at it as New York did and as this 11th Circuit looking at Georgia law, they could read in here that the Illinois legislators do not intend to have negative equity as part of the price of a collateral under the UCC.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Zaff.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Next case.